It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farad. Remember, this is day one of Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive. You can support Central Time and Wisconsin Public Radio with your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Right now, it's time for an extended edition of our Wisconsin News Roundup.
Another Marquette University Law School poll came out this week, gauging the opinions of Wisconsin voters. We'll see how Governor Walker, Ron Johnson, Russ Feingold, and others fared.
We'll also get new details on the proposed civil service changes by state Republicans, and Democrats have suggested making some legislative changes of their own.
For the latest on these and other topics, we're joined by Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we always watch for these Marquette Law School polls when they come out, new one out Wednesday. How are voters feeling about Governor Walker right about now?
Well, not great. I believe after Walker dropped out of the presidential race, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said that you always pay a cost anytime you seek an office and don't win it. There's a political cost, and that's what shows up in the Marquette poll. Walker's approval rating is at 37% in Wisconsin, according to the new poll, and disapproval is 59%. So that is the worst rating Walker's had in the poll. And you know, it's a case where he's never had much approval from self-described Democrats, but he has lost support among Republicans, and especially those who is sort of independents who lean towards Republican.
And the straight up independent category was not looking good for him either, as I recall.
Yeah, that's where a lot of the loss of support was, and I think you have to tie it directly to the presidential race. There were only of Republicans, only 30% said that only 25% said that they are glad he ran and wish he'd stayed in the race. And overall, only 35% of all respondents said they wanted him to seek a third term as governor. Now, it's a little early to talk about a third term as governor, but there it is. So
it's a challenge, as you say. The Senate leader Fitzgerald had said there's a price. It's a challenge trying to juggle a political day job with running for a still higher office. Do you think now that the governor's back in the state, he'll be able to start trying to turn these numbers around?
I mean, yes. I think that it's likely that that things get sort of get back to normal, especially as the political year of 2016 ramps up. What tends to happen is what you have right now in this poll is a bunch of people who lean towards Republicans who are not very happy with Governor Walker right now. But ultimately, when it's sort of hot and heavy political season, they lean towards Republicans, and they're going to continue to lean towards Republicans. I don't know that this is a signal of some kind of a landscape shift, but it's definitely a big challenge. It's not where, you know, if you're a politician, you don't want your approval to be underwater.
Right. With presidential polls, we keep saying, well, it is still months away before anybody starts voting. Well, it's years away before Governor Scott Walker has to worry about people voting for him.
Right. That's exactly right.
Now, let's turn to a race that is coming up a wee bit sooner than anything Governor Walker will face, and that's the race for Wisconsin's U.S. Senate seat. And this one, people from around the country are watching. This is one that people say, hey, this could go either way. Russ Feingold, a rematch with now incumbent Senator Ron Johnson. What are we seeing in the polling there?
Sure, a grudge match. Love a grudge match. The Marquette poll found a big lead for the former Senator Russ Feingold. He had 50% support among the registered voters that they polled. Johnson had only 36%. So that is a 14-point lead for Feingold. It's also a big bump from what the poll found in August, when Feingold had 47 and Johnson had 42. It's a small drop from what the poll found in April, when Feingold had 54. But you'll notice that none of these numbers add up to 100, and that's because there are a lot of people who don't really have an opinion about this race. And in fact, the poll found that 19% of the respondents were unable to rate either candidate. So these are registered voters too. It's not a random sample of people off the street. They're registered voters, but it shows that it could be wild. The pollster Charles Franklin, who conducted the poll, wrote that this is a recipe for volatility until the campaign moves into full swing.
these are not strangers here. This is somebody who was elected to the Senate a couple times, and then the guy who's been in that seat for the last five-ish years now. So there are still some voters who don't know who either of them, or one or the other, or even both of them are.
Yeah, and or they sort of don't know how they feel about them. People are funny, you know. You think that that people follow this stuff, but I guess maybe not.
And this race is in full swing now. I'm getting emails from both campaigns all the time, and in my work account, sometimes my personal account. These guys are running, and neither of them likely to face a significant primary challenge, I imagine.
I have not heard a single word of that. Russ Feingold is, of course, sort of beloved by the Democratic base, and I have not seen any. I think you could say the same about Ron Johnson among the Republican base. So sort of Tea Party favorite Ron Johnson is. I haven't heard anything about a primary challenge. So yeah, we're in for a while. I think, you know, and it's a presidential year, so that makes a big difference. The 2010 race was a midterm, and there's a different sort of electorate in a midterm compared to a presidential race. The electorate in general is a little older and a little wider in a midterm. That likely favors the Democrat. That's the way it usually works in politics. But it also matters a lot sort of what the economy looks like in the next year, and how is Hillary Clinton's campaign doing in Wisconsin, and how are people feeling in general about Congress in a year from now? And that's a long time too. That's still a ways off.
We're talking right now to Robert Mentzer about the biggest stories from around our state. We'll get to our state legislature coming up in a few in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the top Wisconsin news stories of the week with Robert Mentzer from the Wausau Daily Herald. State Democrats unveiled a proposal this week that would protect certain good government laws, they say. Here's Democrat Fred Kessler. He was with us yesterday.
One of the things that's happening is we're seeing a real attack on what we think are Wisconsin's traditions of basically open government, and it's being manifested by a number of bills that are being offered by the Republicans that we feel are really going to work to the detriment of the whole community.
Robert, Kessler and his colleagues have a whole package of legislation, even a constitutional amendment. What kinds of things are on their agenda?
Yeah, so the constitutional amendment is probably the centerpiece. I mean, that gets your attention, I suppose. The proposal is to protect the state's open records laws to make it to make it impossible for legislators to easily monkey with them, as was proposed just before Labor Day weekend this year. Republicans had a proposal that would have exempted a lot of the documents and materials as they deliberate on legislation would have been exempted from open records requests. That prompted a huge backlash, rightly, speaking as a journalist, like those are important tools for ensuring open government, and it was withdrawn. And so Democrats are, it's a political move. They're a minority party. They want to sort of capitalize on that, and also stake their claim in opposition to those maneuvers. And then there are other parts of their sort of package that include opposition to proposals to remake the Government Accountability Board, as well as to remake the state's the way the state does John Doe investigations. Both of those are areas that have caused trouble, been annoying to Republican lawmakers, including Governor Scott Walker, and they've been targeted for changes as a result. And so Democrats are saying, don't change them.
With that open records idea in particular, there was bipartisan opposition to those changes. Some Republicans in the legislature joined Democrats, and some conservative groups were not happy about that either. Do you think that that might see some kind of bipartisan support?
I mean, it's a constitutional amendment, so that's a pretty, it's a very high bar, right, to reach. It's hard to see, but not impossible. You know, who knows? I couldn't say for sure. I think that the message was pretty clear, and I think any politician who was interested in keeping his or her job heard the message that that people did not want those open records changes to happen. And I think that the politicians who were involved in it were embarrassed by it and felt that it was a bad political move. So, you know, I don't know whether the constitutional amendment will get traction or not. That will be interesting to see. But I do think that there's a clear message that Democrats see it as a winning political issue here because the backlash was so pronounced.
Talking to Robert Mentzer from the Wausau Daily Herald about the top Wisconsin news of the week. As state Republicans, Rob, made headlines this week when they introduced their bill to reform the state's civil service system. In a nutshell, what kind of things are they changing here?
Well, I'm glad you asked. The civil service system, that Wisconsin has strong protections for state employees, and this is tens of thousands of state employees. The system that we have is in place since 1905, and it came straight out of the progressive era of Wisconsin, so it was signed by Governor La Follette then. The idea then and now is to keep state jobs from being sort of political plums, and the hiring should be done based on merit and not as a tool for political bosses. This was, of course, the standard practice in the 19th century, and still, you know, modern day Chicago or New Jersey. And we in Wisconsin don't want to have that type of system, this sort of patronage political systems. So on the other hand, there is an argument that, well, you know, 1905 is 105 years ago, and maybe the system is not exactly at peak efficiency. So there's a civil service exam. This proposal would do away with the civil service exam and allow instead hiring based on resumes and interviews, the way that probably what most of us think of as a hiring system. It would make it easier to it would create merit pay system for state employees, and it would make it easier to fire employees who underperform.
We had one of the bill's authors on the show earlier this week. Here's Republican Representative Jim Steinecke.
So what we're really concerned about is getting people in the door in a timely fashion and attracting the best quality candidates. And currently, when the state's hiring process takes anywhere from 100 to 200 days, sometimes even more, just to hire a single candidate, oftentimes when these agencies are making job offers, their best candidates are already gone.
So is this efficiency argument we just heard there the main case that Republicans are making?
Yeah, and I mean, you got to say, that's a long time. 100 days to offer a job is a long window. If you're looking for a job, you might not want to wait half a year, you know. And so it's not that so there's an argument that has some merit for making the changes. It's just more, I think, the issue as raised by Democrats, the sort of good government groups, is what are the protections against these patronage systems or political hiring and firing.
Finally, Gannett Wisconsin Media's investigative team put out a report this week that shows that multiple offense drunk drivers, so repeat offenders, continue to be a problem in the state. What do we learn from the report?
Yeah, so this is something that, of course, our news organization has done deep reporting on, and others have too. We've known that Wisconsin has an issue with drunken driving for quite a long time and quite a serious issue. So this week we took a fresh look at data on chronic drunken driving. So what the I-Team report found was that statewide there were 822 drivers convicted of fifth offense OWI or greater, convicted five times or more as of 2014. And that number is not changed from 2013. It's actually up a little. It was 819 in 2013, and it's essentially flat over the last years that we looked at. It's interesting to look at this group of chronic drunken drivers. We know that if you look at you know, if you go back a couple decades compared to the 1970s or 1980s, there are many fewer drunken driving deaths and drunken driving crashes than there once were. So on the very sort of big picture, you'd have to see this as a public health success. But there's this. But the fact is, it's still a serious issue. There's still more than 200 fatal drunken driving crashes a year in Wisconsin. And on this question of these just habitual chronic drunken drivers, there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement.
And one of the quotes from the reporting on this, I can't remember who it's from, but something to the effect of, when somebody has that seventh time, say, offense, that's the seventh time that they've actually been caught drunk driving. Who knows how many times they didn't get caught?
Yeah, of course, of course. And we've seen a lot. You know, this is something that lawmakers have done a lot on in the past, I don't know, 8 years, 10 years. They've rolled out tougher penalties. There are drunken driving court programs, some new treatment programs. So that might be an area of development. But it's hard to reach these people when people are that determined to drink and drive. It's hard to know the solution.
Rob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Robert Mentzer, storytelling editor for the Wausau Daily Herald and Gannett, Wisconsin Media.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When you read the newspaper, in print or online, chances are that you're seeing a lot more male names mentioned than female ones. A new study finds that the difference can be as much as 5 times more mentions of men than women. It doesn't always matter whether the leadership at a given paper is male or female.
Joining us now to talk about the findings is one of the authors. Arnout van der Ridt is an associate professor of sociology in the Institute for Advanced Computational Science at Stony Brook University. Arnout, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, how similar would you say the situation that you found in newspapers with men being mentioned 5 times more often than women, how similar is that to what we think about as the glass ceiling, say, in corporate America?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I think that most people would guess that if you opened up a random newspaper on a random day, you'd expect to find more coverage of men than of women for reasons of inequality that we're familiar with. But I think it's very surprising to find that ratio is really 5-1, that it is that dominant. So in that sense, there's really a difference between our real-world experience, where we find women, catching up with men and even outperforming them in certain areas, such as in college graduation rates. But then when we open up the newspaper, then all we're talking about is men.
Now, when you look at the context that people are mentioned, are we talking about any reference at all, or are you breaking it down to experts and people who are reported on themselves? How do you sift through that?
Absolutely. We broke it down by a newspaper section, as well as by the slant of the newspaper organization. So what we did was we sifted through over 2,000 newspapers using computational methods, and every time that we encountered a name that referred to a human being, then we counted that and classified that based on the name as either a woman or a man. And so we end up with this enormous big data set. And in that big data set, we break down where these name references occur into female and male name references and in different sections. But we find that both in the business section and in the entertainment section and in the sports section and in all the other sections, men are by far more dominant than women.
And you also looked at, people you might think of as famous, people who have name recognition, and you compared them with people who maybe get a mention once, maybe twice in their lifetime. How does the coverage compare when you look at those two categories?
Right. So the connection with the glass ceiling that you mentioned before is very important here. So the glass ceiling is this well-known phenomenon that women have caught up with men except above the glass ceiling. So there is this idea, this glass ceiling, where women cannot pass through, where they are blocked off of leadership positions in organizations. And it is precisely above the glass ceiling that newspaper coverage focuses on, and not a little bit. Pretty much all the coverage is about the people who live above the glass ceiling. So that's why that ratio is so off, because all the women live below the glass ceiling. And so this is where this exaggeration of this everyday inequality occurs. So women are a little bit behind men, but because at the top it's only men, CEOs, movie directors, and so on. This is why this ratio is 5-1 in the media. And this gives audiences the impression that power and newsworthiness and visibility is really something that is associated with men, and maybe creates in the minds of audiences this idea that it is a natural state of the world.
So is this because these women who are, as you say, below the glass ceiling are not doing things which are newsworthy, or is it because the people who are above the glass ceiling, namely we're talking about men here, have brand recognition and it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle because these are people who have cultural cachet who kind of want to hear about each other?
Yeah, it's probably a little bit of all of this, but it certainly poses the question, why is it that we only talk about people above the glass ceiling? Certainly a lot of interesting stuff happens among people who are not in leadership positions. In fact, you could say in a lot of industries, that is where all the important stuff is done. And the talking heads is the people that we give attention to and give the microphone to.
And how many publications did you take a look at, and how did you measure the mentions?
Yeah, so we looked over both historically as well as in newspaper databases where we have scanned records of newspapers, as well as in modern data sets where we have online newspapers. We processed all these issues day by day, weeklies also, just went through and captured all the names in there through a computational system that recognizes whether something is a name. Occasionally we make a mistake, like when Mickey Mouse is in the news, we might think that is a person. The computer still makes those kinds of mistakes, but most of the time we get it right. And based on that system, we arrived at this very skewed sex ratio in the news.
Now, you looked at papers where there were more women on the masthead sometimes than men, women in those upper editorial leadership positions. What kind of difference did that make, if any, in how much women were reported on in that paper?
There are certainly differences between newspapers. So there are newspapers where that focus perhaps on women. An extreme example would be, say, the Women's Wear Daily. And you find it in a news organization like that. There are also many women employed in editorial positions and in other leadership positions in this organization. And you can contrast this maybe with a more male-oriented newspaper like a Financial Times or a Wall Street Journal, and there you'll find a lot of men in the organizations. And indeed, that journal will cover men to a much greater degree. And this might give the impression that it's really just the men in the news industry who are doing this. So we blame the media for this. Because you've got these female organizations talking about women and male organizations talking about men. But what we did is we looked at all instances where a male editor was replaced by a female editor to test this idea that the gender of the newsmaker matters. And what we found is there was no difference at all. So if a male editor was replaced by a female editor, that left the coverage rate completely unchanged.
Why would
so
that
women
be?
Women were covered to the same degree.
Ahan, why would that be?
So the reason is, and this is speculation on our part, we have no evidence for this, but we believe that there's a very limited role that individual editors and journalists and newsmakers in general can play. The news is fed to them, and it comes from the real world and from news wires, and that is a world in which, above the glass ceiling, men are dominant. And it doesn't really matter what choices these individual newsmakers make. That phenomenon whereby the most visible individuals and the most at the top of organizations come to the surface, that will always happen. It doesn't really matter what field or domain you look at.
We're talking right now with Arnoud van der Ridde, Associate Professor of Sociology in the Institute for Advanced Computational Science at Stony Brook University. He's talking about his new research that shows that in newspapers, a big newspaper study, that men are mentioned 5 times more often than women are. And Arnoud, let's get to the effects of this right now. You know, for the news reading public, that includes men and women, includes maybe some younger people, maybe high schoolers who are reading these papers. What's the effect, do you think?
Well, I think there's a risk here that you know, the dominance of men in newspapers may create this subconscious association of men with newsworthiness. And it's really just a byproduct of the glass ceiling, the men above the glass ceiling, you know, dominating. And this might make it normal, unconsciously, maybe, you know, unintentionally. You would expect to see a man at the top of an organization because that is normalized through the media coverage that reflects the status quo. And so I would, you know, we really need a transformation on the ground where women do reach those top positions. And there are, of course, very influential celebrity CEOs that do make it to these top positions, and they do have a significant impact by making it normal that you also see a woman in a top position.
So it sounds like you're saying that the place that needs to affect change is in, you know, the corner office. It's above the glass ceiling. If change happens there, then we'll start seeing women written about more often in the media, not the other way around, which was something I was wondering about. Could it be sort of a chicken or the egg thing, that if you started seeing more women written about in the media, well, then maybe you'd start to see that reflected in corporate boardrooms?
Yeah, it is something that is very difficult to evidence, but it is certainly an intuitive cycle that we might be able to break this vicious cycle by seeing more women above the glass ceiling, paying more attention to them in the media, and thereby inspiring women who might think that it's impossible to make it to that level, to try and reach that and break the glass that way.
Now, you're talking about newspapers here, but do you have an idea whether this is consistent with other media, say, you know, radio, for instance, or online blogs, that kind of thing?
Yeah, so our news database actually contains not just the traditional newspaper, but also the online news site, like, say, a CNN.com or even NPR website is in our database. So we are pulling a variety of sources here. But what we've also done is we've looked at social media and to see if we find the same patterns back, and we really do. So on Facebook, for example, you see that among individuals who are mentioned only once or twice, women are slightly ahead of men, presumably because people are simply talking about their friends. And women are perhaps a little bit more active on Facebook than men. But then once you look at posts of people that are very famous, you again see this extreme ratio of 5-to-1 back, where also on Facebook, you know, the big conversations are all about men.
Arno, what are the next steps in looking at this issue for you?
Well, there's one open question that we have left unanswered, and that is, suppose that you have a man and a woman who have the exact same type of achievement, exact same role in society, and if we identified such pairs of people who are highly similar, but the only difference is that one is a woman and the other is a man, is it then the case that in the media the man is getting more attention than the woman? And that is really a question that we haven't been able to answer yet. But we could, in principle, do with this methodology, and it is something that we look forward to getting insight in.
Arno, thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
That was Arno van der Ridt, Associate Professor of Sociology at Stony Brook University. He's the author of the newly released study called A Paper Ceiling, Explaining the Persistent Underrepresentation of Women in Printed News.